I loved him as a player, right? But you wouldn't want to parent that way. You can get a lot of purpose out of something, and it's important to have, but it can also be miserable. It's hard for me to define that as leadership in kind of an admirable way. And my point of view is like, man, if meaning matters to you, which it probably should, why not just try and build that into everything you do now?
Howdy, everyone. I hope the weather is awesome where you are. It's rainy where I am now in the DC area, but that's not always a bad thing. Rain sometimes puts me in a thoughtful mood. It takes me back to my roots in Florida, where sometimes it would just get incredibly dark almost every day during the summer around 3 p.m. and thunder and lightning and end of the world for around 30 minutes to 45 minutes or an hour. And that meant we were inside, often with the power out and nothing to do but think and play with whatever toys or books we've been ignoring. And so gave me a lot of time to think then. And that's the perfect mood to be in for my guest today, John Coleman. Like my guest last week, John is actually also a classmate of mine from Harvard Business School, where John and I met and instantly hit it off. John is a veteran of finance, was at Invesco for a long time, is currently a managing partner at Sovereign Capital. And John really is a very thoughtful guy himself, very well read. That's how we start our conversation today. So if you're looking for some book tips, stay tuned. John was an author at Harvard Business Review, or rather is an author at Harvard Business Review, authoring various articles for going on 12 years now. And he's the author also of the HBR Guide to Crafting Your Purpose. And couldn't we all use a little more purpose in our lives? I'm sure that's true today and will be in the future. So definitely enjoy my interview with John Coleman. I know I did. Enjoy the show. Well, I figured we'd start out, as I was stalking you to catch up on the last, whatever, 13 years since business school, I noticed you wrote some articles in your prolificness, if that's a word, prolificity, I don't know, it's got to be something. It's not pro-life, it's something in that realm. You have articles around book recommendations. So just so I don't lose it, not that this is the most important thing we have to talk about today, but I've got to ask you what's on your list. You know, you can do it however you want. You could do top ever. You could do best of 2022. What should people be reading?
Oh man, what a great question. So, you know, I do have a top ever list, those books that I often come back to. One is very cliche. I figure I read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, actually a version called The Emperor's Handbook, probably every couple of years. And I just think it's such a timeless set of wisdom. It's about 20% weird stuff, actually, I find, and about 80% timeless wisdom. But it's so, you know, short and accessible and practical, because it was never written for publication. It was written to be almost his own notes, almost the way that Ray Dalio wrote The Principles about how to manage himself and his life and his empire effectively. And so I always find that's great. You know, another that I always come back to, again, relatively cliche, but an awesome read that I read almost every year or two is A River Runs Through It, which is almost a novella by Norman MacLean. I love the story. MacLean wrote it in his 70s, and it was his first book. He was an English professor, a literature professor at the University of Chicago, and he had actually lived this like wildly exciting early life as a forestry service guy and a lumberjack and all this other stuff, and then became a literature professor at Chicago. And then wrote this just absolutely gorgeous little book about fly fishing and brotherhood and brothers and fathers, which I have two brothers. I am a father. You know, those types of relationships I find really intriguing. And then lately what I've been reading, you know, it's been a split. A few years ago, to get out of current events, I started reading a lot more history books, especially biographies. And I've found that those are some of the easiest books to read on Audible or to listen to on Audible. And it's just been fascinating to run the gamut, right? And so I've kind of attached to a few different authors that I think are really good, tracing different parts of history, and then a few other books here and there. Walter Isaacson's books on like Steve Jobs, Leonardo da Vinci, Albert Einstein. I read the Einstein book this year, are phenomenal. The Jobs bio, I don't read a lot of contemporary biographies. I'm not into that. But the Jobs bio was actually very good, very good. And then a lot of other kind of political history stuff. So I like Ron Chernow, as a lot of people do. And the Hamilton and Washington biographies he wrote were amazing. And then just some more eclectic stuff. Adrian Goldsworthy has the two kind of best books on Julius and Augustus Caesar or Octavian Caesar. And those were exceptional. And then I'm currently reading or listening to a book by Simon, and I'm getting the last name wrong, I'm sure, Sabag Montefiore on Stalin, which is fascinating. Wow. It's kind of about Stalin's cabinet and his rule. So those are not timeless classics from which you can take leadership lessons necessarily, but I find just by reading broadly about history, you kind of by osmosis pick up lessons that can be helpful as a leader practically.
I love that. I've never seen or read A River Runs Through It, although it's just like it was such a thing back however many decades ago. Was it Robert Redford and Brad Pitt and I don't know who else, but it was
definitely Brad Pitt. I don't think Redford was in it. And the book is like, the movie follows the book pretty well, but don't let the Brad Pitt movie scare you off the book. The book is it's one of these things that's just so beautifully written. And if you love the outdoors and the Western mountain states and fathers and sons and brothers, it's one of the most amazing little books you'll ever read.
That's great. That's great. You picked up on what I didn't say, which is I think that movie came out at a time where a lot of guys probably didn't realize what a genius of an actor Brad Pitt really was. so it was easy to discount back then. You definitely mentioned some other things that are near and dear in terms of Marcus Aurelius and that sort of stuff. You said something interesting there, which is and I do this. Two, and maybe it's just a habit of MBAs or business leaders, you definitely mentioned leadership a couple times there, you know, without any prompting from me. I characterize this as a little bit of a mix of a few different influences, but all kind of revolving around this center of leadership. How do you identify as a leader? How do you define it? And why does that come to the fore for you so suddenly?
Yeah, leadership. Gosh, I mean, there are so many definitions of it. I think it's, in its broadest basis, leadership is about defining a mission greater than self and helping to point people towards it, at least the way that I think, and to achieve that mission effectively. And I know that's probably not the kind of dictionary definition or the one that I used to have the privilege of working with David Gergen. I'm trying to remember how he defined it. He had a really succinct definition. But the components of it for me are really defining something greater than self. And that's not part of everyone's definition. But if you're just leading people to yourself or for your own ambitions, I find that's more, it's hard for me to define that as leadership in kind of an admirable way. Certainly there are bad leadership, so I'm defining good leadership, but I think it's often a mission greater than self, or at least not just confined to self. And then I think it has to be pointing others. So it's all about leading others, where you can marshal an audience towards that, or a group of people towards it. And you can either do that with formal control or informal influence, right? You can be a leader in a situation where you're a peer or where you have superiors if you're able to effectively move people in the right direction. And then the third component of it for me is being effective, right? Trying to achieve that effectively. Because if you lead people towards something, but it fails, you're unable to reach that goal, then it's hard to characterize that as effective leadership. And so those are a few components for me. I know others would differ a bit. And there's this term self-leadership that people have, which I don't disagree that you should discipline yourself, et cetera, but I'd probably use a different term for it.
Yeah. Even some thought leaders on leadership, it's kind of leadership-ception or something like that. We'll use that term self-leadership. And I don't know, it's always kind of weird to think about what that's like, but yeah, I think I increasingly I'm aware and excited about kind of this idea of like multiple selves inside you and, you know, playing them off against each other. Like I think, what was Kobe Bryant's like, alter ego was Black Mamba. And, yeah. I think Beyonce's was Sasha Fierce or is Sasha Fierce. And like, and so people have these like other things and they personify them. And maybe that's more useful than, kind of not naming the other voice inside you or something like that. I don't know.
Well, and you thinking do have to be able to alternate personas a bit, right? Because the way that I deal with my 4-year-old is different than the way that I deal with my wife, is different than the way that I deal with the people that I work with. And so if you don't have, you know, if Kobe turned on that hyper-competitive instinct he would use on the basketball court at home, that would be dysfunctional. Right? It would be suboptimal, at least from what I saw. I loved him as a player, right? But you wouldn't want to parent that way necessarily. Right. And so I do think different contexts require a bit of a different persona from people.
Yeah. Yeah. You've had a lot of investing experience with Invesco and now Sovereigns Capital. What can a leader learn from investing and maybe vice versa?
Oh, wow. That's such a great question. What can a leader learn from investing? Certainly, investing is about rigorously holding yourself accountable to results, right? For a particular company or real estate development, whatever you're investing in, I'll just say company from here forward because it's easier to characterize it that way. And we do mostly venture and private equity. And so that's near and dear to my heart. I think, you know, investing forces you to put your fiduciary hat on and recognize that you're marshaling someone else's resources. And you have to be a really good steward or fiduciary of those resources, which requires you to be really thoughtful and analytical and rigorous about the success of the enterprises that you're investing in. And so I think that accountability and that rigor and that measurement and management are really important for leaders, because sometimes it's easy to kind of follow your gut or be emotionally driven about something, but it might actually not be in the best interest of the organization or the group that you're leading. And investing certainly is all about trying to be rigorous about that, at least when it's successful. The other thing that I think is fascinating as a leader about investing is just the broad purview that you get. You know, we are not building individual organizations, although we build our own investment firm, but we see thousands of organizations. We encounter hundreds of leaders, and it's almost the best parts of business school, if you and I think back, where you're just seeing all these cases of extraordinary people in very different circumstances, and these founders and owner-operators who are just amazing people in their own rights. And so I find that every day I learn something new, both about business and the context in which we operate, as well as about leadership, because you encounter people who are so different from you, but are so effective at what they do and so passionate about what they do. And then on the contrary, what can investment learn from leadership? I think a lot of investing is all analytics without any leadership, without any organizational might, right? Without the ability to think about what it takes to actually grow and run a company or a real estate development, whatever it might be. And I think that investors don't realize how reliant they are on great leaders and how much they have to evaluate leaders, right? And so if you're approaching investing just from an analytical perspective, without knowing who you're partnering with who you're entrusting to build this company, to take care of the money that you're putting to work, you're missing half the equation, because half the equation is the talent that you're coming alongside to partner with.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You use the word, I think, intentionally there, although it has the same meaning generically, which is case, earlier in terms of all these business cases, right? So those who are familiar with business schools, you know, are probably familiar with the case method. Those who aren't, you know, it's a whatever, you know, 4 to 10 page packet of material on a situation. That then, you know, prospective business leaders will debate with their professor, kind of facilitating, and that's how it works at Harvard Business School, where John and I went. So I've got to ask you: is there a case that stands out in the leadership realm to you that, you know, really, really resonates?
Man, this is not a good leadership answer, but whenever someone asks me the most memorable case at HBS, and you're going to laugh, it was that chicken contact lens case. Do you remember God. This thing? Like, I cannot forget that. It like plagues my dreams. The, story was there was a guy. So apparently chickens like attack each other when they're in close quarters. And so, and this is not very pleasant, but they'll like chop off their beaks from memories so they can't hurt one another in close captivity. And so someone developed a much more humane set of contact lenses where you could like put them on the chickens and they wouldn't attack each other. And they weren't successful. And we spent like an hour and a half debating it. Maybe you remember a different conclusion than I, but like it was easier. It was like cost effective. It was efficient at doing it. And they never caught on. And all I remember is the synthesis was like, you're never going to get people to use chicken contact lenses. It was like too weird. Maybe I'm remembering the outcome wrong. I will say, you know, it wasn't strictly a case, but one of the things I think back to often was a person that I admired that you probably had contact with too, which was Clay Christensen. And his article, which wasn't exactly a case, but it was almost his life as a case, How Will You Measure Your Life, is one where I go back to some of the lessons from that pretty frequently as a leader. I would rank it one of my top three or four leadership articles ever. And just insights, like he says, it's easier to do something 100% of the time than 99% of the time, which is, you know, if there's something you really need to abide by, for him, because of his religious faith, it was observing a Sabbath, right? And he knew he just had to observe it because something was always going to interfere and there'd always be an exception. And if he tried to do that 1% of the time, it would grow. And that's been a great lesson for me just about establishing hard lines on certain things. Mm-hmm. And then he had a variety of other just brilliant insights in that. So those are two of the things that we read in business school that I come back to. What about you? What do you remember from that time?
Well, those are those are some great extremes there. I can't help but talk about the chicken contact lens one since you brought it up, which is our section. We debated it probably for less than the full hour and a half, because at some point after a lot of prognostication and analysis and debate and business, you know, strategy around this idea, I won't mention his name, although I'm tempted to, I won't do it without his permission, but, a guy in our class who had a great sense of humor, but also was extremely bright, all of a sudden just kind of blurts out like, guys, what are you talking about? These are contact lenses for chickens. Like, this is crazy.
It turns out that was the right answer.
It was the right answer. Yeah, it was the right answer. And so, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's a leadership case. Maybe it's not. I mean, it certainly wasn't in that class that we took on leadership. But yeah, it's kind of like at some point you got to wake up, right? And just see the big picture here and be a human for a second, you know, with some common sense. Of many, obviously, that stand out, and it's amazing how you remember them, where just coming out of the military with a, you know, extremely strong work ethic. I mean, everyone who shows up there probably has a really strong work ethic, otherwise they wouldn't be there. But, there was it was an interview situation. They were doing like a power day at some hedge fund, and it was kind of comparing the candidates, and one candidate in particular, I think he did the best out of anyone performance wise, like on all the questions and, you know, cultural fit and all that sort of stuff. But like, but it didn't seem like there was some kind of hard things around like balance in life and all sorts of stuff like that. And I remember at the time, my take was very different than it is now. At the time, it was like, well, like, it doesn't seem like this guy, you know, really wants to put in the effort. Also, he's not willing to like play the game, right? And kind of to some extent, right, going for a job or whatever, like, you kind of play the game. But at the same, like, my opinion is now, like, actually, that guy was like extremely wise and was true to himself. I guess that's the benefit of age and experience, I suppose. But yeah, that one definitely sticks with me.
Yeah, I don't recall that particular case, but that resonates with me a lot because as you get older, you learn like not everything is worth chasing, and you got to know yourself. And it is really, you know, I think I would too often get caught up in chasing the right thing without evaluating whether it was the right thing for me, you know, like the thing that everybody else wanted to do, the thing that was prestigious. And I do reflect back on some of our classmates or some of the protagonists that we saw in the cases and think it takes a lot of discipline to know who you are and know whether there's a right thing for you, because time is shorter than you think it is. I think when I was 27 years old or whatever we were in business school, you feel like you've got forever. Yeah. And now, you know, I wake up every day kind of mid-career and think, what is it that I'm going to do with this little bit of time I have left? And is it the right thing for me to do? Is it the right mission for me? And so I love that insight from you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cool. I definitely want to talk about, you know, the bulk of your recent work here. Sorry, I unlocked my notes. You know, in terms of crafting your purpose, unpacking purpose on every level, I think to maybe get us started, one of your book recommendations, speaking of your book recommendations earlier, is a biography of Alexander the Great. And then you've got another article that I took a look at and I hadn't seen him before, which was Success to Significance, I think, by Tom Buford, if I have the name right, in Harvard Business Review. And those two kind of struck me as interesting, right? Because, and not that you were saying, hey, everyone should try and be Alexander the Great, but, you know, as far as, you know, one of the most dominant and successful, if you want to, you know, say that mass violence is success. You know, successful leaders in world history. You know, and then I think the Tom Buford article is not necessarily, you know, advocating that, but in, you know, a very different type of significance. And and then you've got your own probably definition of that. So I'm curious, what does significance mean to you, John?
Yeah, I think this is one of those things, and it's something that I do write about a lot for HBR, and even in my most recent HBR book. I do believe that significance is very individualized, right? And I genuinely believe now, especially the further I get in life, that significance is not always about acquiring the most leadership, the most power, the most influence that you can possibly have. That's perhaps the right life for some people. And I'm very grateful to some people who have done that, right? If we didn't have an Abraham Lincoln or a George Washington, people at the top of what they were doing, then our country would not be what it was, right? There are, you know, other examples of that. But I also, you know, I've run into people who were great parents and that's what they did. And, or they were great writers, individual contributors, and that writing really changed people's lives, right? And so I think that significance is very individualized. I think the other mistake that people like us make sometimes is to define significance purely in terms of our work. You talked about the balance of the protagonist in that case you were talking about. And as I've gotten older, I just realize how much significance there is in the rest of my life and how much purpose there is in the rest of my life, whether that be my kids, my friends that I'm leaning into, the community service that we're doing. And so I guess one message that I'd give people is A, it is very individualized. B, it's not just in your work, right? That it's all around you. And then C, that it does change over time. And one of the things that I kind of reject in that success to significance framework, which you're referring to, is a lot of people right now live in a way where they say, well, I'm just going to go make as much money as possible, acquire as much power, you know, until I'm 55 or whenever my peak career is over. And then I'm going to switch and I'm going to have a second career, a second phase of life, a second mountain where I try and do something meaningful. And my point of view is like, man, if meaning matters to you, which it probably should, why not just try and build that into everything you do now? Like, why wait, right? And, you know, if you look at some of the great leaders in history, and Alexander the Great was a great leader in the sense that he was very effective at accomplishing his mission, which was to take over the Persian Empire and a little bit beyond. But you read about him, and it would be hard to characterize him as, he's not a particularly noble figure historically. I mean, with just the atrocities that they committed were even shocking by those standards. And it was never clear kind of what he was accomplishing it for, other than just the power of it. Whereas you look at other great, truly great leaders in history, right? And all of them have their vices, right? So Albert Einstein was like a terrible dad and, you know, all that. Steve Jobs was a little bit of a lunatic sometimes. But you read the people that you actually admire, like George Washington was one for me. You read that Chernow biography of Washington and contrast it with Alexander the Great. You know, Washington, in a way, accomplished something every bit as professionally meaningful as Alexander the Great. He founded a new country that went on to become the most important country in the world and the most powerful in the history of the world. And yet, he was a deeply moral person. He had flaws, but he actually worked to correct those over his life, right? And would often change. He was morally respected by the people around him. The reason people acclaimed Washington as president, were ready to select him as king, was not because he was just an effective military leader. It was because they trusted him, right? Because he was actually a deeply moral person that they felt they could trust. And the reason he turned it down was because he was trustworthy, right? And there was that great line from King George at the time, I think it was, who when he heard the news said, George Washington's the most powerful man in the world, I think, or something in that order, because he had turned down the most powerful job in the world at that time, or something that could be the most powerful. So I know I'm rambling a bit, but if I circle back to your question, I do think this idea of thinking about what significance means in your leadership and life is important. The idea of really thinking about it individualized, not just imitating someone else, but figuring out what it means for you, in combining this success and significance, because success without significance, I think, ends up being a little hollow for people.
Hey, gang, quick note here. I've moved a ton of my efforts in terms of content creation to LinkedIn. So if you don't follow me on LinkedIn, please do. I've been posting a lot there. I've gotten a lot of great feedback. Feel free to stalk my profile and check out a lot of the old posts. Most of them should be evergreen. I very rarely comment on today's news. I post on the same sorts of topics I post on here. Leadership topics, as well as things about business, things about really just getting out of your own head, right? And trying to achieve the goals that you want to achieve in your life, but can't seem to sometimes, or maybe aren't doing so fast enough, or maybe just aren't finding fulfilling. There's a lot of things that we can do, practical tools that we can apply in our own life. I try and share them here, but for the stuff that doesn't go into this, because a podcast is a lot of work. I'm not sure if the word's gotten out. I love it. That's why I do it. I do it because it's hopefully providing value to you, but I can't put everything into a podcast. So I do that generally on LinkedIn now. I'm also on Medium. I'm also on Instagram, those sorts of things. But LinkedIn is where I'm at right now. So please follow me. My full name is Andrew Sridhar. That is S as in Sam, R-I, D as in David, H-A-R. That's how my dad used to spell it all the time on the landline phone growing up. And even though I go by Sri, you will find me under both those monikers on LinkedIn. So hope to see you there. Enjoy the rest of the program.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I've got 1,000 other questions I could ask you, but I want to give you a chance to kind of frame what, if not the fundamental question, at least is the first question for a lot of people, which is, how do I find my purpose? So whether it's someone early in life who is, you know, really doesn't know, or someone who maybe they've done the, you know, the, like you said, the, you know, maybe the opposite kind of path that you're advocating, which is, hey, they've gone for whatever, 20 years in their mid-career, and they're like, okay, this has no meaning. What do I do next? Where do people start?
Yeah, such a great question. And, you know, I started this journey, Andrew, when we were in grad school, because we wrote, if you remember, with two colleagues, two classmates at that time, Oliver Segovia and Daniel Galati, wrote this book, Passion and Purpose. And this idea of purpose kept coming up with our classmates. You know, we were in school during the great financial crisis. We saw a bunch of stuff collapsing. People were thinking about this significance versus success thing very much at the time. And I remember my very first book event was at the Coop in Harvard Square. And an undergrad woman stood up and asked me, how do I find my purpose? Which is like an obvious question to ask of a person who wrote a book with purpose in the title. And I just remember, man, I could not answer it well. Like somehow I had not anticipated that question. And it bugged me for 5 or 6 years. Like, why is it so hard to answer that question? Why can't I answer that question? And I eventually came to believe, probably in 2015-16, I had formulated this idea that that question contained three fundamental flaws. And that's the premise of this new book, The HBR Guide to Crafting Your Purpose. The first of those is that purpose is a thing that you find rather than something that you build. I think often we kind of search around and wait for something to define our lives. And my point of view is actually, you have sources of meaning and purpose in your life right now, but what's incumbent upon you is to take those and maximize those, to craft those into something even more compelling. Like that young lady was studying at Harvard, big achievement, right? She had friends, she was doing community groups there. She was probably serving others in some capacity, family. There were all these opportunities for her to have a really meaningful set of experiences if she turned her attention to those, rather than like fixating on this idea of finding one thing that was going to turn her life around forever, right? And that it would hit her like a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. So the first is it's something you build rather than something you find. The second is that it's not a single thing, but multiple things. So if you think about the way people frame it, how do I find my purpose? Singular. A lot of folks are looking for that Mother Teresa moment where you like encounter the one thing that will define your life for the rest of your life and be your kind of singular focus. And Andrew, you talked about maturing a moment ago and how your perspective shifts. I think with the benefit of hindsight, that's a question a lot of young people grapple with, but it's almost never the way that people actually live. So even if you look at those with singular accomplishments, one of the examples we use in the book is Marie Curie, the great scientist, first woman to win the Nobel Prize in sciences, won it in two different disciplines, which has still never been replicated. Mm-hmm. She was just remarkable, one of the greatest scientists in history. Her lab partner was her husband. She loved him. She wrote a book about him. She had these two daughters, one of whom almost won the Pulitzer Prize, one of whom won the Nobel Prize in her own right. Was, I think, the second woman to win a Nobel Prize in the sciences, although I may be getting that wrong. And she just lived a really full life. And you read in the Einstein biography by Isaacson, you know, he was friends with Marie Curie. And he recounts, Isaacson writes about how they would go hiking in the mountains with her daughters. And, you know, just all this fun stuff where you see these people as whole people. And so I encourage people, you don't want a singular source of purpose. And that's not the way most people live. Instead, you want to find all those multiple sources of purpose around you in your fuller life. And then the third is that most people think that purpose is stable over time, like that one thing to transform your life. And I think instead that it changes over time. And so you and I have had this experience, Andrew. I know you served in the U.S. military, for example, and that probably was a very fulfilling mission for a period of time. But you decided that there was it was time to move on from that at some point and take on a different mission in life. And that's the way we all grow, right? If you think about being a kid, playing high school basketball, moving on to college or military service, getting into mid-career, being a grandparent, embracing those different phases of life and how your meaning shifts over those times, I think, is one of the keys to really unlocking purpose. And so I know that's not a direct answer to the question, how do I find my purpose? But the real thesis of the book is that that's the wrong question, that instead we should reframe purpose in those three ways.
I like it. I like it. That's super helpful. And I think your approach probably makes it less daunting to people. So that's awesome. So maybe by way of example, how have you struggled to find your purpose let's say, you know, craft your purpose, I guess is the better way to say it.
Man, I could give you examples from my entire life, I feel like. And you know, one of the reasons I write to learn. So anytime you see me write a book, it's typically because I'm like grappling with something and writing forces me to like dig into it. And, you know, I have often struggled with this idea of purpose. Like, what's the purpose of my life? What am I doing the right thing? Am I wasting my life? And I've felt that way multiple times. I mean, since high school or college, like, what am I supposed to do? And, the most recent version of that was even writing the book. So I started writing in 2019, and in mid 2020, during COVID, as I was, you know, pretty deep into a draft, I woke up to the idea that I was not really achieving a greater sense of professional purpose in my professional life anymore. Right, that I'd been at the same company for about 9 years, 8.5 years, And it had been a great experience. But if I was really honest about reflecting on the principles I was encouraging other people to embrace at work, it was no longer working for me, or I was no longer feeling that I was on the right mission. And so I actually switched jobs at that time. COVID was like not the best time probably to switch jobs, but I did it nonetheless. And we were talking earlier, you know, I had worked at a big company. They were largely an ethical company. Like, I had some great colleagues. But I found that it was time for me to dig in first to something that was more of a startup, where I could help shape the culture, where I could really try and build something rather than come alongside people who had already built something, one that was deeply values aligned. So more in touch with my personal set of values so that I could feel more deeply on a mission. And one where we could actually shape kind of a segment of an industry in a way. So not just build a firm, but build kind of a new practice within an industry. And that realization, which took about a year and really was, you know, it was funny. I'd write stuff in the book. I'd interview people. I have the benefit of, you know, as a writer, you get to say, hey, I would love to interview you for my book and get to learn from people. And as I interviewed these folks, I would go home and like process the lessons about my own job search. And it really guided me to reshape my professional life, I think, and to recommit, as a lot of people did during COVID, to the balance of that life. You know, I'd been traveling 4 or 5 days a week. I try and keep that more limited now, because I learned it wasn't just quality time with my kids; it was quantity time. Mm-hmm. And more flexible work environments worked for me. And so there were a variety of ways in which COVID helped to shift the way that I crafted my own purpose. But I realized when I took on the book that I was struggling with a sense of professional purpose, and that writing it actually helped me to reshape that and switch my career.
Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying this episode of The Warrior Poet. I know I am. On that note, I have some exciting news. I plan to start coaching a limited number of participants who want to get unstuck, who want to raise their game for their business, their career, their startup, and hopefully improve their impact on the world through greater leadership skills, and someone who can be there one-on-one to sanity check the voices inside their head. If you love the content that I've been producing and you're using it in your work, in your life, then I strongly encourage you to reach out and apply to this program. I currently have a group that I've been mentoring. They're getting a lot out of it, but I'm looking to go one-on-one. And I figure my listeners of The Warrior Poet are the best place to start. So again, limited number of availability slots open. I will have up to 5 people at a time for several months, maybe even longer if we develop that relationship. Most important thing is that you get a lot out of this. So I'm starting here. I'm starting at a heavily discounted price. There will be only 5 slots available. I'm going to keep this super simple. You don't have to go to a website. You don't have to reach out to me on social media. There's no contest here, a la YouTubers and something you have to do. Basically, you just need to fill out the Google form that is going to be listed in the notes. Again, super excited to do this one-on-one coaching with you to help you understand and internalize the Warrior Poet leadership philosophy that I've developed from years in the military, SEAL teams, Naval Academy, things I picked up at Amazon and in tech startups, as well as my MBA at Harvard Business School, which, again, as you've listened to this program, you've probably seen me poke some holes in that leadership curriculum. And maybe that tells you a little bit about how my leadership philosophy can help you in your life. So please, please, if you at all think this might be interesting, I encourage you to fill out the form and I will reach back out to you and sincerely hope that we get to talk in real life. Back to the show.
How do you think about passion? Which I feel like passion is one of those words that maybe goes through these like 10 to 20 year ebbs and flows in terms of how the culture embraces it. You know, I think we're at a low in terms of passions, like street cred, you know, and I think, you know, the book Career Capital, I'm usually really good with author names. I can tell you are as well. I can't remember right now who wrote it, but you know, I think that book does a does an effective job at dissuading people from following their passions. But at the same time, I think there's a little selection bias in there where, hey, let's pick an example of someone who had a boring job that they thought was boring, but where they learned some skills and eventually they got what they wanted, which is autonomy and, you know, creativity and kind of financial success. But I think there's some selection bias there. Like I know plenty of people who are in jobs just like you do, right? I won't offend anyone by mentioning those job functions, but where they're attractive financially, but like they've been doing it for 10 or 15 years, maybe more. They have climbed the ladder. And so they've gained some of those things like autonomy and the other things that, again, maybe you remember the name and you can help me out here. He articulates in the book, but they're not actually happy, right? They don't feel like, if we ask them, right, have you been effective at crafting your purpose? They would probably say no, like 80% of the people in some of these fields.
Yes.
I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Passion, this idea of passion and purpose and success, you know, I wrote an article a while back about a different version of work-life balance. Right. And the idea was we think of work-life balance as like how much time do I spend at my job versus like at the gym versus at home. And I said, actually, a balanced life is one that balances, because I think in 2x2s, because I'm a former McKinsey consultant. So it was like built into me at a very young age. But how do you balance like joy and purpose in the things that you do? Right. Purpose is being on a mission, Andrew. And again, you know this better than I do. Right. Because I think, in military service, it's one of those fields where the sense of mission and sacrifice for mission is the highest. And regardless of your experience, you at least met people who sacrificed an incredibly great deal in pursuit of a higher calling. And so purpose can be, you can get a lot of purpose out of something, and it's important to have, but it can also be miserable, right? You can end up sacrificing so much for so long in pursuit of that purpose that you don't ever have any fun. Right, which is part of what you're describing. I want to circle back to the money thing because I think that's a different thing. But you know, you meet people like this all the time. It's like the teacher who's struggling in a public school environment or school environment that's not conducive to him or her. They're putting in 90-hour weeks. They really love their kids and they're investing in them, but they're going to burn out. Right? It's someone in military service who's been deployed too long and actually is at their breaking point and can't do it anymore. And so they've got like purpose without joy, and it's unsustainable. Right, is the way that I view it. You get people who have a lot of joy or passion in their lives, right? But no purpose and no mission to which they're pointed. And it's kind of vapid, right? I always think of the book, The Great Gatsby, and a number of the characters in there, they had all the leisure time. They were wealthy. They didn't have to do anything. They like went out in boats and played tennis. But it was a totally meaningless, ultimately lonely existence, right? Because they had leisure and fun and all that stuff, but they weren't, you know, they had passions, but they weren't really living purposefully. And so I think it's in balancing those things that you get the most fulfilling life. And again, that shifts over time where you're getting those two things. But I think passion or joy or happiness is important in that you really can't do something for more than a short defined period of time without any joy or passion in what you're doing. Like this buckle down, I used to say I can do anything for a couple of years, right? And maybe that's true, but like you can't live your whole life that way. You actually do have to enjoy what you're doing sometimes where it gets miserable. You also have to have a purpose. And so I think really passion is important, however you phrase that, but you've got to hold that in tension with purpose, meaning mission. Being on something greater than yourself. Because if it's just passion, I think it's kind of empty. And I also think it can be misleading as you're working into a field, right? Like, there are other great frameworks you can use, but like, I love music, love listening to music. I can't sing, I can't play music. It'd be great if I was like, I'm going to go be a musician. I would be terrible at it. I would ultimately fail. Like you can be passionate about something and suck at it, right? And that's not, that's not a good recipe for life either. So I don't think it's sufficient, but I do think it's necessary for a good life. And then maybe the one other comment, I'm sorry for speaking so long, Andrew. I'll keep my soundbite shorter.
Great.
You know, I have been coming back to again and again and again lately with people, this idea of, you know, money really doesn't get you to happiness or fulfillment in life. And it's funny because we all kind of know that. Like if I say, oh, you know, money doesn't buy happiness. People, oh yeah, you know, obviously that's true. But like every day we kind of live like it would, right? And every day I hear people talking about this linkage between just having a little more materially and being happy. And all the statistics say that after a certain point, right? Like I grew up poor. I don't know what your upbringing was like, but like being poor is definitely worse than being rich, right? There are rich people problems. Poor problems are worse. Like if you don't know where you're going to get food or shelter or you're sick or it's worse, way worse. And obviously those folks are in the worst situation. After you get to somewhere between $80,000 and $120,000 is what people say in the US, the statistics vary a little bit. There's no correlation between material prosperity and fulfillment or flourishing or happiness. And if you look at it on a country scale, actually some of the most lonely, angry people without purpose in the world right now are in the richest countries. You know, the lowest ranking country in terms of meaning at work is South Korea, one of the richest countries in the world. 6% of people rate work as somewhere that gives them some meaning. Right? 6%. That's like almost one out of 20 people would say that their work is meaningful to them. And there's just no correlation. Whereas you can look at middle income countries where people are living multi-generationally in homes, they don't have nearly the material resources, but their self-described happiness is like through the charts, right? Because they have a balanced life. And so anyway, I know that's not exactly the question that you answered, but I do think it's one of those things that's so obvious, but you have to keep it front and center, which is conflating, you know, I talked about passion and purpose is something that you need to balance. Conflating material success with purpose is an error that people like us often make. And you get to the end of that, honestly, the finish line where you think you're rich enough that you're, you know, you've achieved your goal. And it just ends up not being what you thought it would be. Or for most people, it ends up not being what you thought it would be. So sorry for the tangent, but yeah, I find that comes up a lot.
It's all great. It's all great. And I think that I like how you framed the passion as joy. And I think that's valid and also very useful because passion's really easy to dismiss, right? As some youthful naivete, right? Or, you know, someone being immature or unproductive or impulsive, but we all do need joy in our lives, especially since we're spending so much time at work. So I like the way you framed that. I'm going to ask a hodgepodge of things to close us out, and you totally. you can answer whatever you want. So you know, one thing that occurs to me is the concept of ikigai, and maybe a concept is too narrow, but you know, I think it's I believe it's Japanese, right? And it's kind of overlapping, you know, the various parts of your life and trying to find, you know, that balance and intersection. And so, like, I can't in a lot of the things you're mentioning that's in the back of my mind. I'm not sure if that resonates with you. The other thing that's been in the back of my mind is, you know, Charlie Munger's, Warren Buffett's partner, for everyone, his idea or habit of inverting things and figuring out, okay, we could talk about what we should do, but maybe we could talk about what we shouldn't do. Right. So, you know, I'm curious also, how you think we fool ourselves in crafting our purpose. What are the things that the traps people should avoid falling into as they look to craft their purpose and build a great life?
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that. You'll remember the circles better than I. It's three or four circles in Ikigai, right? Where it's like the intersection of like what you're good at and what the world needs and or something like that and what you enjoy. There are a few different circles.
Yep.
And I've seen the Ikigai framework, and then there are a couple of others that I've seen. And I think that's exactly right. I mean, you pick one of those, I think, but like it's kind of what I was trying to describe in it elegantly before, which is like, especially in a professional career, like in your hobbies, you can be a musician and suck at it and it's fine, right? I can go write poetry and be bad at that and it's fine. I can work out at the gym and be terrible at it and look over and see all these other better, more fit people and it's fine because it's a hobby, it's self-improvement. Professionally, you do have to work at the center of like, what am I good at? Because ultimately you're not going to enjoy doing something long-term that you're not good at. Like what builds on my strengths? what do I enjoy? Because ultimately, if you hate your job, even if you're good at it, you can't do it forever, which is what we just talked about. And then like, what does the world need, right? Like, is there a need for this? So, you know, I may be good at something and I may enjoy it and there may be like no need in the world, right? and you can't get paid for that. And ultimately money doesn't buy happiness, but without any sort of professional success or money, you probably are in dire straits as an individual. And so, and it's more fulfilling to create something that people want. And so I absolutely love that concept of balancing those different topics in the way that you described. The Munger inverting your life concept, I don't think I'd ever heard before. That's fascinating. Like what's an application for you, Andrew, where you found that to be compelling? Illustrate that for me if you don't mind.
Good question. I don't know if I'm sure he would apply it to his life. Not that we're like drinking buddies or anything, but but I've heard it applied to like a number of things. So for instance, I'm gonna butcher the quote, so I won't even try, but Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger credit a lot of their success to avoiding mistakes. And so
yes,
like, you know, the first question isn't necessary, and maybe I don't know if this resonates with you as an investor, but you know, maybe one of the first questions they ask is not, is this a good opportunity, but what are the reasons this would be a bad opportunity? And then applying some filters on, you know, management, you know, are they incentivized correctly? Are they the right cultural fit? You know, organizationally, ethically, right? And those easy filters enable them to avoid pitfalls that, you know, otherwise they might convince themselves weren't a big deal unless they're explicit about it.
Yeah, I love that. We, you know, I will ask a question on those lines with almost every investment we do, which is if something were to go wrong, what went wrong? Like if we look back on this in 5 years and it went terribly wrong, like how bad did it go and what went wrong? And it forces you to think through the risk factors in something. I think that's a critically important lesson for investments, right? Because it's not all upside, it's downside protection too. You've got to think about your risks. And you get so much deal momentum as an investor. You get so fired up about something that it's easy to overlook flaws, especially as the process develops. And you constantly have to check yourself and say, am I getting too excited? Are there flaws that are popping up that are actually concerning, et cetera? I think in the context of a life, it's absolutely valid. You know, one of the things I did in my career search, which I just talked to you about a few years ago, was this is, again, a very nerdy thing. Your readers are losing respect for me by the moment. But I, with my wife, I went through and just documented, like, what are the 10 things that matter to me in a professional job? And it was like one of those brutally honest rankings you probably wouldn't show to your like kindergarten teacher or your classmates or your friends necessarily. But we basically said we have to rate the things that are meaningful in this. It's, you know, including the unsavory stuff like money and power and prestige. And then the stuff that you could put out to your friends, like lifestyle, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I went through the 10 things that I thought were most important to me and actually rated, like said, kind of what does that mean in my context and how important is it? Like, I actually gave him a percentage rating again, because I'm a nerd. And then every job that came in, I would rate 1 through 10, how well it accomplished each of those criteria. And then I had a weighted composite score at the end. And going through those 10 factors and how much they mattered with my wife, it was a great way of actually checking myself. Like if I weight this much, if power suddenly becomes like the most important thing here, what could go wrong there? Like, what are the negative components of that if I actually pursue this job because I've weighted that thing so much? And, you know, that's a very obvious example where certain things like money and power, you actually do. I mean, it's important that people have them, that some people have them, and they're things that each of us have in some respect, but they can distort you, right? They're things that can distort you because there are lots of temptations in those. And so thinking through those and how to manage those ahead of time in a personal life, I think is incredibly important.
Warrior Poet is a property of Rainiac Productions. If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Shri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Shri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoon Man and me, Shri.
No, 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 no. Kevin. Mina dua. Spita.